Hello and welcome to this 36th lecture course about the Greeks and the Romans, whom we're going to be investigating as an integrated pair. My name is Robert Garland. When I was growing up in England, I started taking Latin at the age of 7 and Greek at the age of 12. I then went on to take classics in high school. It was thought to be a fit background for anyone contemplating a high-flying career in any profession. Its advocates always claimed that it gives you a well-trained mind. My headmaster, who was a great fan of the Greeks and Romans, liked to say that if you're a classical scholar, you can pretty well do anything. You've even got the wherewithal to be the captain of a nuclear submarine. I never actually tested the proposition myself, though I pass the same general belief on to my students in the hope that they'll realize they're not studying stuff that has no value. So, that's one reason why I'm standing here. But there's another. What really turned me on to the ancient world were the Roman epics that Hollywood made in the 50s and 60s. Ben-Hur, Spartacus, Barabbas, and so on. They were all about maleness and testosterone and acts of incredible heroism. Though the Romans usually end up as the scapegoats in these movies, I felt a huge admiration and awe for the sheer vastness of the world they governed. And later, when I read Virgil's Aeneid, a certain sadness for what it costs to run an empire and to be the world's only policeman. It was somewhat later that I became passionate about the Greeks. Greek literature seemed all about fumbling your way to adulthood in a massively confusing world. Achilles, for instance, as he's portrayed in Homer's Iliad, discovering that there is no justice in this world. The prizes and honours do not go to the most deserving. And that when you stand up for what you believe in, you may destroy what you love most in the whole world. A truly existentialist dilemma. Today, I've just given you the very short version of my early fascination with Greece and Rome. I feel I need them both the Greeks and the Romans, to make sense of the world I live in, to grapple with its moral dilemmas and complexities, and to know, quite simply, who I am. Which makes this course relevant. Although the word relevance is one that most historians tend to shy away from, I do firmly believe that this course has a lot to teach us about the modern world. Firstly, whether we like it or not, we are the heirs of the Greeks and the Romans, architecturally, philosophically, legalistically, culturally, and in so much else besides. The Greeks and the Romans have definitively shaped the way the West sees the world. Much of the bad, as well as the good, I have to say, in the way we see the world. And secondly, our course has also a lot to tell us about how closely related cultures intersect and play off one another. Sunnis and Shias, Israelis and Palestinians, Irish Protestants and Irish Catholics. It's not the case, however, that an integrated approach is generally used in the teaching of Greek and Roman history. On the contrary, most scholars are historians of either Greek history or Roman history. They do their research in one field or the other, and that's always been the case. If we think of the really great names, in the 18th century there was Edward Gibbon, a Roman historian, and in the 19th century, Barthold Niebuhr and Theodore Mommsen, both Roman historians, and George Grote, a Greek historian. The intersections between Greeks and Romans are so vital to each culture, however, that this traditional approach is methodologically suspect. It's only by studying the two cultures in connection with each other that we can come to an understanding of that unique cultural entity that is Greco-Roman. Already, Plutarch, who was the Greek author of a famous set of parallel biographies of Greeks and Romans, recognized the value of examining the Greeks and the Romans alongside one another. And in language teaching, at least, it's been common practice since the end of the 19th century to teach Latin and Greek in the English public school, which is what I was subjected to. There's also a developing awareness that Mediterranean studies is a legitimate area of investigation in ecological, social, economic, political, and cultural terms. Some of the leading scholars in this area are Arnaldo Momigliano, Peter Green, Eric Gruen, Ramsay McMullen, and Fergus Miller. But even so, much of the research that I've drawn on has been done by scholars who identify themselves as either Greek or Roman historians. So, we're embarking not on a well-trodden path, but one that is quite fresh underfoot. And that makes it particularly exciting for me, and I'll try to convey some of that excitement to you as well. We're going to be looking at the numerous ways in which the Greeks and Romans complemented each other, coincided, and not infrequently collided. I want to point out two ways in which Greek and Roman history differ from each other. And firstly, let's deal with the terms the Greeks and the Romans. The Greeks and the Romans did not have a clearly defined national identity in the way that the Brits and the Americans have clearly identified national identities. In fact, the sense of belonging to a particular nation is a comparatively recent phenomenon, which took its present form as late as the 19th century. So, the question is, how did the Greeks and the Romans know that they belonged to these particular groups? Well, that's easier to answer in the case of the Greeks, where Greek equals Greek speaker. Even so, there are problems because there were a lot of people who spoke Greek, the Macedonians, for instance, whom a lot of Greeks thoroughly despised because of the thickness of their accent. In the case of the Romans, the word Roman only means being native to the city of Rome in the early period. Unlike Greek, Roman does not equal Roman speaker, or rather Latin speaker. There were, in fact, numerous Italic languages, languages, that is, that were spoken in the Italian peninsula. Latin, which is named after Latium, territory around Rome, was merely one of the major subgroups spoken in central and southern Italy. And once the Romans began to expand out of Latium, into Italy, and out of Italy, into the Mediterranean, they increasingly, albeit under pressure, extended Roman citizenship till Roman eventually comes to mean anyone living under Roman rule. So, we need to be aware that when we're talking about the Greeks or the Romans, we're using rather loose terms of reference that aren't invariably even mutually exclusive. The second point is this. Greek history does not have a single focal point comparable to the city of Rome, which ultimately comes to dominate the entire Mediterranean. Whereas Rome was unchallenged in her dominance, Greek history displays a power play between a variety of communities that sought to dominate the Greek-speaking world at different times, which advance and recede, like Sparta, Athens, Macedon, and so forth. I'd also like to point out that we're beginning our course in the early first millennium BC rather late in the history of Mediterranean culture. If we're to talk about the dawn of Mediterranean culture, to use a rather outmoded expression, then that goes back to around 4,000 years BC. We're going to take it through the archaic period, the classical period, the Hellenistic period, the early imperial period, the period of late antiquity, into the Byzantine era that begins sometime in the 4th century AD. There's no consensus among scholars as to exactly when. It's named for Constantinople, formerly Byzantium, which became the capital of the Roman Empire. And throughout almost the entirety of that span of about 1,500 years, Greek and Roman culture were in uninterrupted dialogue with one another. Politically speaking, the Romans were the outright winners, in that it was they who came to dominate the Mediterranean and to lord it over the Greeks. But, and it's a very important but, it was Greek culture that came to dominate Roman culture, a fact which all educated Romans freely acknowledged. And we're also going to look at that very special entity that we call Greco-Roman in all the ways that it was not just Greek and Roman in opposition, but rather Greco-Roman inseparably joined at the hip. We're going to examine the variety of cultural products that exhibit a decisive Greek influence, even though in almost all cases, and this is very important, the Romans adapted and developed what they took over from the Greeks in their own individualistic way, consistent with their own ideals, traditions, values, and so forth. And finally, we're going to look at the ways in which the Greeks and the Romans lived similar lives and shared a similar mindset, just as all ancient peoples lived similar lives and shared a similar mindset. So we're going to be doing a lot of comparing and contrasting between the two peoples, always alert to the fact that they resembled each other much more than either of them resembled us. And though there's a chronological direction to the course, we'll also be examining many thematic issues. So many of the lectures will range widely over the centuries in order to give proper focus to the subject in hand. The course is structured as follows. The first 11 lectures are going to focus on, firstly, some of the features of life in the Mediterranean that the two cultures experienced in common, and secondly, on the story of their political interaction down to the point where the Greeks ultimately succumbed to Roman rule. The next 8 lectures, that's 12 through 19, are going to look at the consequences of the Roman conquest in terms of their relationship with one another. And these lectures will also examine their somewhat similar approach to what we might call human universals, such as death, leisure, and sex. And then the following 10 lectures, 20 through 29, will explore the emergence and development of Greco-Roman culture, primarily from the reign of the Emperor Augustus onwards. And in the final 7 lectures, 30 to 36, we'll look at how the Roman Empire confronted the particular challenge posed by Judaism and Christianity, both of which had profound connections with Greek culture, and how the relationship between the Greeks and the Romans continued to evolve until the empire split into a Greek-speaking East and a Roman-speaking West. So, our question, who were the Greeks and who were the Romans? To try to answer it, we have to pose another question, which is, who did the Greeks and the Romans think they were? And that takes us into identity history, how peoples construct a sense of who they are as an ethnicity or community. We're going to be answering it by drawing on evidence from mythology and archaeology. We obviously have to use mythology selectively, but it certainly helps us to answer the question, who did they think they were? And I'll keep coming back to the Greeks, even when I'm talking about the Romans, since the Greeks had a shaping hand in forging Roman identity, by which I mean in shaping how the Romans had a sense of themselves. So who were the Greeks? Historians are generally agreed that the emergence of the people whom we call Greek was associated with a migratory wave or waves. We don't actually know when this event took place. In fact, the whole question of the coming of the Greeks, which deserves to be put in quotes, is extremely complicated. What we do know is that Greek was probably being spoken on the mainland as early as the 15th century BC, and at the latest by the 13th. That's because we have proof of Greek in the form of a Greek language script called Linear B, clay tablets inscribed with the Linear B script have been found in a number of Mycenaean palaces. The script seems to have been used primarily for administrative purposes. So that makes the Mycenaeans, the people whose culture was centered at Mycenae in the Argolid, that's to say in the northeast Peloponnese, unambiguously Greek. Or at least, on the road to becoming Greek, if we concede that the creation of a cultural identity is a long and complex process. It was the Mycenaeans, incidentally, who besieged Troy, perhaps around 1270 or maybe a century later. Historians argue over that too. Then, following the collapse of Mycenaean civilization around 1200 BC, or in some centers, rather later, there was a break in cultural continuity that lasted several hundred years. And we call that period of Greek history the Dark Age, and we should probably put that in quotes too. The Dark Age is so named because writing disappeared and communication with the outside world was very limited. The greatest achievement of the age was epic poetry, which was in origin an oral mode of composition, which only much later got written down. Think of the poems of Homer. Epic poetry probably, in fact, wouldn't have come about if writing hadn't disappeared. Its greatest products are the Iliad and the Odyssey, and by extension, the Roman epic entitled the Aeneid. Every people, every ethnic group, has a vested interest in demonstrating its antiquity, and the Greeks were no exception. Their name for themselves was Hellenes. In the classical era, and perhaps much earlier, they traced their name back to a man called Hélène. That's H-E-L-L-E-N. And he was a son of Deucalion and Pyrrha, the equivalent of Adam and Eve, the ancestors of mankind. They were also the sole survivors of the Great Flood, the equivalent, therefore, of Noah. And this made the Greeks, according to their reckoning, the oldest people on the face of the earth. According to legend, there were two main ethnic groupings that constituted Greek identity. Number one, the Ionians, who were autochthonous, that's to say, they were inhabitants since time immemorial, and the Dorians, who were immigrants. Both the Ionians and the Dorians claimed descent from Hellene. However, the Dorians claimed descent from Hellene's son, Dorus, whereas the Ionians claimed descent from Hellene's grandson, Ione. In other words, the legend provides an explanation for a perceived ethnic divide. The Dorians originally lived in central and northern Greece. About a century after the Trojan War, however, they migrated south to the Peloponnese. They were accompanied by the descendants of the hero Heracles, who had previously been expelled from the Peloponnese, and they were now reclaiming possession of the land. And the Greeks identified this event as the Dorian invasion. To this day, however, scholars are undecided as to in what sense this was an invasion. There's no conclusive archaeological data to support it, and the main evidence is based on dialect. The Greeks spoke in a number of different dialects, Doric and Ionic being the main ones, though the distribution of Doric and Ionic falls far short of providing proof of this racial theory, since Doric was also spoken in southwest Turkey and in Crete. And there's another problem. The earliest full account of the Dorian invasion occurs only very late, in the writings of Diodorus Siculus, Diodorus of Sicily, in the 1st century BC. But what's important for our purposes here is first that the Greeks genuinely believed themselves to be descended from two main groupings, and second that they exploited the ethnic divide for political purposes. The Spartans, for instance, believed themselves to be Dorians, descended from the great-great-grandsons of Heracles, and actually they did speak Doric, whereas the Athenians thought of themselves as Ionians, and they did speak Ionic, or at least a dialectal subdivision of Ionic that we call Attic. And mention of the Athenians and the Spartans brings me to another point about Greek identity. When we talk about the Greeks, we tend to focus upon the Athenians because Athens was unrivaled in its cultural achievement. But Athens wasn't all Greece. There was Sparta, Corinth, Thebes, Macedon, and in a later period outside mainland Greece, the great cities of Alexandria, Antioch, and Pergamum. And they were all Greek, but quite distinctive as well. The Greeks also thought of themselves as an ethnic group completely distinctive from non-Greeks. The historian Herodotus, for instance, tells us that in 480 BC, when a Spartan embassy arrived in Athens, fearful that the Athenians were going to side with the Persians at the time of the Persian invasion, the Athenians pointedly defined Greek identity. They used the expression to Hellenikon, which means literally Greekness, as number one, having the same blood and language, two, acknowledging the same temples and religious rituals, and three, observing the same customs. And I think that's as good a definition as we can come up with. It was the wars that the Greeks fought against the Persians in defense of their land, the wars I've just mentioned, that actually constituted the single most important factor in helping them to forge a sense of ethnic identity, of Greekness. For the first time in their history, they stopped squabbling among themselves and pooled their resources, at least temporarily, in the face of a common foe. Greek hadn't meant much to them up to this point. Now it did, because it enabled them to define themselves in opposition to the term barbarian. So from this point on, the Greeks would define themselves in opposition to non-Greeks, and that meant in opposition not only to the Persians, but also later on to the Romans. So now let's turn to the Romans. As in the case of the Greeks, we need to ask the question, who did they think they were? And to answer it, we have to look at their myths. Here we have two myths of racial origin. The earlier one, in terms of the dramatic chronology, involves a Trojan prince called Aeneas. Aeneas was a particularly useful figure to the Romans because in the Iliad, in which he appears as a Trojan hero, Homer tells of a prophecy that he would one day rule the Greeks. When Troy was razed to the ground by the Greeks, so a later story has it, Aeneas escaped from its ruins with his young son. He then wandered around the western Mediterranean, trying to establish a new homeland. He eventually landed in a place called Hesperia, the western land, in other words, Italy, specifically at a place that was later called Lavinium, on the west coast of Italy, not far from Rome. Lavinium is very interesting archaeologically. I'll talk about it in a moment. It's yielded a large number of Greek finds, which is very interesting in connection with Trojan Aeneas. Just an interesting aside on the word Italia, Italy. It's probably a Greekized form of an Italic word, Vitalia, meaning calfland. It was originally applied to the southern half of what we would call the toe of Italy, but it gradually extended over time to incorporate more and more of what we call Italy, until by the 3rd century BC, it identified pretty much the same geographical area as it does today. So the very name Italia owes something to the Greeks. But back to Aeneas. At Lavinium, he formed an alliance with a local people called the Latins, the inhabitants of Latium, so named after King Latinus. The alliance resulted in wide-scale intermarriage between the Trojans and the Latins. Aeneas himself married Lavinia, who was Latinus's daughter, after whom Lavinium was named. And when he died, his son founded the city of Alba Longa, the precursor of Rome. And here we come to the second myth of racial origin. Sometime later, the daughter of one of the kings of Alba Longa was raped and gave birth to two twins, Romulus and Remus. On the orders of their evil uncle, the two infants were exposed, left to die. But a she-wolf found them and suckled them. There's a famous bronze statue of the pair being suckled by the wolf, probably dated around 500 BC, and it's one of the earliest works of Roman art. The twins grew up, and in time their royal identity was revealed, and Romulus founded Rome and became its first king, though only after killing his brother in a fit of rage. So, what we have here is a disjointed foundation legend which falls into two disparate parts that have been somewhat awkwardly cobbled together, the Aeneas part and the Romulus part. And this is where the Greeks come in again. They just keep popping up. Dionysius of Halicarnassus, a Greek historian, writing in the time of Augustus, claims that the first person to suggest that Aeneas founded Rome was Hellenicus, a Greek mythologer and chronicler who wrote in the late 5th century BC. So if Dionysius is right, the suggestion that Aeneas was the patriarch of the Roman race may well be Greek in origin. The Romulus part, on the other hand, is almost certainly a native Roman legend. Even so, it seems to have been a Greek writer named Alcimus, we don't know much about him, who first engrafted the Aeneas legend onto the Romulus legend. So the Romans owed the Greeks a debt for telling them who they were, or rather, for telling them who they thought they were, as well as for giving them the name of their country. What greater debt could one people owe another? Well, is any of this true, or is it just wild speculation? Interestingly, recent excavations at Lavinium have brought to light possible evidence of a hero shrine that may have been established in Aeneas' honour dating to the 4th century BC, though even if the identification is accurate, it only proves that the Aeneas legend was well established by that date. It doesn't obviously prove that it was true. What's important about the Aeneas legend, however, is that it offers an ideological orientation. The Romans were in effect saying, firstly, that their culture was very ancient as the Greeks, and secondly, that they succeeded in forging a sense of cultural identity because of their readiness to assimilate foreigners, the story of intermarriage with the Latins. And thirdly, that they were on the losing side of the Trojan War. Rome, we know, was originally a small village in a region that would later be called Latium. But what about Romulus? Was he actually real? Fact or fiction? Is the legend of Romulus true? Inquired a recent edition of Archaeology. Well, there's certainly no evidence of a king called Romulus till centuries afterwards. Quintus Fabius Pictor wrote the first surviving account of Rome's origins, and he lived in the 3rd to 2nd centuries BC, much later. However, an Italian archaeologist called Andrea Carandini has found evidence of a wall on the Palatine Hill, one of the seven hills of Rome, which he would date to about 775 to 750 BC, close to the traditional date of Rome's foundation in 753, which is also roughly the date of the earliest settlement on the Palatine Hill. By the way, they're called hills, but in fact, most of them are just hillocks. However, it seems clear from the work of another archaeologist, the American Albert Ammerman, that Rome did not become an urban entity until about 650 BC, that's a century later. And that seems to be the date when the Forum was created as well. So myth and history join hands. We've certainly come a long way since the 19th century, when the great German historian Theodor Mommsen declared that these stories of Rome's foundation were totally fictitious. And one further point. We might be tempted to think that the average Roman didn't take any of this stuff seriously, the suggestion that his ancestors were Trojans. However, in the generation before Virgil, an antiquarian named Varro wrote a work entitled On Families of Trojan Descent, which suggests that those Romans who could trace their ancestry back to their Trojan roots may have enjoyed something of the same status as the daughters of the American Revolution. Virgil's Aeneid, written in the reign of the Emperor Augustus, also reveals a very serious commitment to demonstrating precisely this point, not just in its general outline of Aeneas's wanderings, but also in stories about the origins of Rome's rituals and institutions, which are traced back to that antiquity as well. There's one other event we need to feed into the mix in order to understand who the Romans were. Sometime in the late 7th century, the Etruscans made contact with Rome. The Etruscans were the most important of the indigenous inhabitants of pre-Roman Italy, and their territory, known as Etruria, covered an area extending to the river Arno in the north and to the river Tiber in the south and west. They occupied a number of cities north of Rome. They came into contact and conflict with Rome because Rome was founded at a major bridging point in the Tiber, one which provided the Etruscans with access to Latium and the south. The wealth of the Etruscans was based on their rich agricultural land and on sizable deposits of iron ore, copper, tin, lead and silver, and they reached the height of their power in the 6th century and first half of the 5th. We don't know where they came from. The Greek historian Herodotus said they came from Lydia in Turkey. Dionysius of Halicarnassus said they were indigenous to Italy. But the general consensus today is that the Etruscan language does not belong to the family of languages that we call Indo-European, which makes them an oddity. They're important because they were undoubtedly the principal conduit through which Greek culture first entered Rome. It was through the Etruscans that the Romans learned of the Greek alphabet and of the Greek pantheon of gods, but the Etruscans also contributed directly to the Romans without the influence of the Greeks, notably in art, religion, customs and languages. To conclude, any match depends on the contributions of two people, hence the term Greco-Roman, meaning of or relating to both Greece and Rome. It suggests there was an indissoluble tie between the two cultures, and indeed there was. What would Rome have been without the imprint of the Greeks? And what would we know about the Greeks were it not for the Romans? In the next lecture, we're going to put this development in its context by examining travel and trade in the ancient Mediterranean. It'll provide us with a necessary background to this whole course, since it was largely through sea travel that ancient cultures, not just Romans and Greeks, but other peoples as well, came into contact with one another indirectly through artifacts and directly through personal exchanges.